Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode 24, or should I say for one night only, Failte Ayr Tuathanaicas Craig Agus Royal. That was good, wasn't it? Oh, no. You must be impressed.
You're past Mark.
I'm your host, Will Evans, and tonight I'm heading up to the Isle of Lewis in the beautiful Western Isles of Northwest Scotland, where they speak Scots Gaelic, to talk to Dual McSween. Dual, how are you?
Okay. I'm really good, but let's just correct a couple of things. It's Scots Gaelic. Not Gaelic.
Okay.
And Gaelic is the Irish one.
Irish, yeah. Okay.
So we're Gaelic, and my name is Dual.
Dual.
Well, you can call me Donald for this, just to make it a little bit easier for you, perhaps.
Okay.
But only teachers call me Donald. I usually go as either Sweeney or Dual.
Okay, and definitely not Dom.
I'm not Dom, Don, or any variations of these letter words.
Okay, well, because when you type it in it actually autocorrect changes your name to Downhill when I was putting it in here. So, so I won't go with that either. But anyway. So how are you anyway? Are you well?
Anyway. Ah, yes, I'm not too bad. I'm a bit hoarse today. We had football last night, our last game of the season. We had a cup final and won 3-2 after extra time. So I am hoarse from shouting at the boys and then the singing afterwards, and also being a little tired and emotional all day, you know, after the celebrations.
Absolutely. So this is exactly what you feel like doing tonight then.
Yes, well, we just got to grin and bear it and pick up the bit and just what I could talk waffle anyway. I could waffle all day long, so I can. It's fine. I can power on through.
Good. That's what I'm looking for in a guest. So anyway, tell us a bit. You live in an extremely unique part of the UK. So why don't you tell us a bit about it?
Well, I'm just glad you didn't say remote, because that's one word that does my nut in when people say, oh, you live in a remote place. And my answer is normally, remote from what? I see us in the Western Isles here as the center of the universe. So we've got everything we need here. So, yeah, I live in Ness, which is in the north end of the Isle of Lewis. The tip of the Western Isles is called the Port of Lewis. So that's about, there's a lighthouse there, that's about a mile away from me as the crow flies, so right up at the very north end of the Western Isles. So yeah, we do live on an island. It is the biggest island in Scotland. Lewis itself has a population of 18,000, so it's probably, it is different to most of the islands, and maybe not the stereotypical image that people have of, you know, a wee island where you can drive around in an hour and there's a few hundred people on and you're all spread apart. We're 800 to 1,000 people in the north end of Lewis, and we're relatively densely populated. So there's quite a lot of people here, quite a strong community spirit.
Yeah.
And but you do know everybody. I know pretty much everybody that I'll see, and when you're driving around in your car, you'll be waving at everybody. You'll know most of the cars that drive past you and stuff like that. So
yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's a good place. I was born here, I've lived here, and I'll be buried here.
Yeah, okay, Because you refer to it as the Western Isles, not as the Outer Hebrides.
Yeah, it's called. Locals generally call it the Western Isles.
Yeah.
The Outer Hebrides. I don't know why. Recently, it's had a bit of a surge in being called the Outer Hebrides. That seems to have come from development agencies and tourism side of things, because apparently those tourists, the further south you go, apparently they know where the Outer Hebrides, they refer to it as the Outer Hebrides, and they like the marketing idea of Outer Hebrides. But I see myself as being from the Western Isles, and I think that's how most people see it. But Western Isles, Outer Hebrides, interchangeable. It doesn't really matter, but I do stick with I use Western Isles, and that's probably probably because of the Gaelic as well. In Gaelic, we'll say Nihelan an Iar, and Nihelan an Iar, you'll see it quite often when there's an election on or something like that. That's our constituency name.
Okay.
It's officially, it's in Gaelic, or Elan Shear. So that's Western Isles. The Outer Hebrides one is Inisha Gaol, which is Land of the Stranger. I'm not going to get into all of the reasons behind that. I prefer just going as Western Isles rather than the Land of Strangers.
So it's got quite a unique landscape there, isn't it? It's quite a very diverse habitat there, isn't it?
Yes and no. We have no trees. That's probably the first thing that people notice when they come here. There are zero trees. I've never climbed a tree in my life. There's just literally no trees grow here naturally. There haven't been for hundreds and hundreds of years, since before the Vikings anyway. That'll be the main difference that visitors would notice. But yeah, lots of moorland. I live on the, like I said, in the north end of Lewis. So we have a community owned estate. So we had a community buyout of the estate 10 years ago, and it's a 56,000 acre estate. And I reckon you're probably talking about 52,000-53,000 acres of that is moorland, peatland.
Right. Okay.
So heather and very rough grazing.
Yeah.
So that's what a lot of it is. Where I am along the coast, we're very lucky that we're along the coast, and we have what's called Macherland, M-A-C-H-A-I-R, and that is sandy soil. And that's very fertile compared to everything else that we have. And the access to sand as well meant that over generations, people here were able to improve rougher, peaty soil by taking the sand in, spreading it and improving the land that way. So that means that the north end of the island where I am is more fertile than some of the other places down the west side of Lewis. We're because of the access to sand, our ground has been improved over the generations.
Okay. But you'd have, would there be red deer there on the island?
Yeah, there's red deer. I mean, when I was wee, the seeing deer was a novelty. So I'm 33, so when I was young, it would be like, oh, there's a deer, wow, that's really cool.
Yeah.
But now their numbers are expanding all the time, and you see them. They don't really come near houses. I've only seen one near the house over the years.
Yeah.
But they're much more prevalent now than they used to be.
Yeah.
But red deer, and the other thing that we never saw. I remember in 1994 or 95, I was in primary 7, the last year of primary school, and my mother saw a dead hedgehog on the road, and this was such a novelty that she put it in a shoebox and was taken into school.
Yeah.
We all got to see a dead hedgehog, because hedgehogs are an alien species here. Somebody brought a couple in to eat up slugs in their garden or something like that, and now they're all over the place. And the best thing about that, the animal side of things is we don't have any predators. There's no ground predators here. There's no foxes, no badgers.
Yeah.
There never have been. It's not a case of they've been wiped out or anything like that. there are no native ground predators here apart from otters, but they don't really have a huge impact on crofting or farming and things like that. So that's one benefit, if you can put it that way. That's one thing I just don't have to worry about. It's not on my radar at all, having to think about that. There are sea eagles and golden eagles and things like that, but personally they haven't had much impact on me. I know other people, since the introduction, the reintroduction of sea eagles maybe 10 years ago, some crofters do lose lambs, and I know of there's a couple of wee dogs that have been suspected of being taken by sea eagles as well. Oh, but personally, okay, haven't had any real negative experience of eagles.
Okay. And the island, and I know from following you on social media, you mentioned the Vikings there, and it's obviously, in terms of historical sense, it's been populated for many thousands of years, isn't it? And you occasionally find quite important archaeological remains there, don't you?
Yeah, I was going to say, do I fancy myself as an archaeologist? I don't know. I don't think I do, but I keep an eye out for stuff. I've got a bit of an imagination, and I like to think about what things were like here, and I always thought it'd be cool to find something. And then last year I found a couple of things. I was burying a ram on my croft, probably start of spring. And while I'm saying I'm burying, we have a derogation here. I know most of the country, most of the UK, you're not allowed to bury animals, but in the Highlands, islands, we're so far away from an incinerator that we're still allowed to bury. Yeah. Anyway, I was burying a sheep, and I was just digging away, and then I found what looked like a skull, and I was like, well, you know, we've been burying sheep for years. I was like, well, that's not a sheep skull, it's not a cow skull. I wonder what it is. So set it aside, finished burying the sheep, and I took it to an archaeologist. He's like, better phone the police just to double check what it is. And I phoned the police anyway, and then they had to send out CID, and it turned out to be a human skull. So CID came out, photographed the area, and they had to make sure that it was. Do you have CID in Wales and England? I don't know. CID would be like the I can't remember if you do or not. Anyway, so the cops had to come out, photograph the scene.
Yeah,
photograph the scene and make sure that it wasn't a recent murder type thing, you know, in the last 100 years or something like that. So the skull was sent away to Dundee, I think, something like that, a forensic unit. And turns out that the archaeologist that looked at it suspected that it was 300 BC to 300 AD, and that it was a child of around 7 years old. Bits of the skull have appeared since then. It was the rabbits that were digging up, and bits were appearing on the surface. So there's a top of the skull that I had first, but then like 2-3 weeks later, the front, the forehead, and the eyes sockets. So that bit is immediately identifiable, and it's like, whoa, that is. Yeah. You know, I'm holding an infant skull, and if it was in the palm of my hand, it was like the width of my palm. And it's like, yeah, that makes, like I say, I've got an imagination that really brings it to life when you've got that in your hands.
Yeah.
So that was the one that's really stood out. But the other thing that I found last year was there was a couple of us, we were down on the Machar, a wee bit down the road, and there was a. It's a bit of an archaeological site that it's exposed to the wind and the sea to a certain degree. So it always gets cleaned up every winter, and cattle come in and sheep come in and stuff like that. It's always disturbed. Anyway, we found last year we found a Viking comb there, which is pretty cool.
Yeah,
and it was I can't remember if it was 800 AD or 800 years. I think it was. I think that would be 800 AD.
It was over a thousand
years old.
Yeah.
So that was really cool. And then you're holding this comb, which is made of antler and bone and stuff like that. And you're like, well, somebody nobody has touched this in 1,000 years. And yeah. It's just like, kind of comprehend, you know, the iPhone that I'm holding right now in 1,000 years time. Yeah, you know, it's it probably will exist, but it's just crazy to think that is happening right where we are. And what I said earlier was, you know, that people say we're remote and things like that. That's because the main mode of transport has changed these days. Today, it's by car, it's road. But 1,000 years ago, 500, 200 years ago, it was the sea.
Yeah.
So our islands and Scandinavia, Orkney, Shetland, Ireland, we were on the motorway. This was the motorway going right past us. So we're at the heart of everything rather than being on the fringe.
That's right.
So it's not a surprise that all these things appear here, and they're really interesting. And you know, I always have an eye out for things. One day, I'm going to find a sword. That's one thing. That's my list. Find a Viking sword.
Yeah, because I mean, obviously, it's like you say. I mean, I guess they'd have on the way from Scandinavia around to Dublin, they'd have stopped on the Western Isles. But I mean, there's obviously still that strong influence there, isn't there? I mean, even in like for my ear, there's hints of Scandinavian even in your accent, you know, because I guess you're so close to that
yes,
part of
yeah,
world,
yeah. Totally. Yeah. They were here for hundreds of years. I think there were something like 400 years the Vikings were here. Don't quote me on but it was hundreds of years anyway. All our place names are of Viking origin. Swain, Bost, Harbost, Bost, Bostadr, that was a Viking for Farum. You know, and you've got islands like Skavpe, Grimsay, Burnery, the A in Gaelic would be Skavpe, Grimsay, Bjarnarai. The I sound there, or the A sound, is island in Norse.
Yeah.
So there's that kind of stuff. And then there's folklore as well. There's a hole in the rocks in the cliffs near the northern tip of Lewis. It's called the Eye of the Butt, Tol the Roy in Gaelic. And the story is that the Vikings liked our island so much that they tied chains through this hole to their longboats and tried to pull the island back to Norway. You know, it's just folklore, just a story. So the Vikings were here. We don't identify ourselves as Vikings the same way as the likes of Shetland do. And our accents are probably a mix of the two, a mix of like the Norse and the Scandinavian influence, and also the Irish and the Gaelic influence. So our accents are a little bit different on the side.
Yeah. Well, that's incredible. I mean, so have your family always been there?
Yeah. My mother is really into genealogy. She's been researching for years, and as far as we go back, we're all Islanders. So I'm, like I said, in Ness in the north end of Lewis, and my grandparents from Ness and from the north end of Lewis, Ballantrushell as well, which is a village further up the road. But then my father is from another island. He's from Scalpe, which is about 55 minutes away. What is it about? No, it's not. It's about, what's it, half an hour to Stornoway away, and then 45 minutes to Tabard, and 10 minutes. So it's, you know, like an hour and a quarter away by car.
Yeah.
It's and three islands away. So he's from a fishing island. So Scalpe's a tiny island. Maybe when he was younger, maybe 500 people there, and it's, you know, a couple of miles wide by a couple of miles long. So that's a totally different island setup. That's probably more like your stereotypical island rather than Lewis, which is so much bigger. But so as far back as we go, it's all Islanders. And you kind of because he's from a different island, I know people throughout, you know, the length of Lewis and Harris. I used to spend all my summers down in Scalpe, and I'd be out fishing, and and that, because he used to fish until he had an accident on his boat in 2005, but he was fishing up until then. And I remember every summer when I'd be going out fishing with him, I'd quite often spend most of the summer fishing, and he'd be drilling it into me. You're not going to be fishing. You're going to have a white-collar job. You're not going to have a blue-collar job. You're going to... I think his dream would have been for me to leave school, get a job in the... go to university, get a job in the bank, and be there until I retire type thing.
Yeah.
But that's not what I said. he was adamant that I was not going to be a blue-collar worker, that I was going to better myself as he saw it. I rebelled against my parents' wishes. Can you believe that somebody would do that?
Yeah, okay. So you were born into a crofting family. So before we go any further with that, can you explain for people who might not know, what is a croft? Because you must get asked that. I know you got asked that the other day on Twitter, but what is it?
It's a really good question, and it's not an easy answer. The answer that people usually give is a croft is a piece of land surrounded by legislation. That's usually what they say, because it's difficult. It's difficult to explain. So crofting, I will give my own interpretation of crofting, which is how I see it and how it works where I am, because it's slightly different in all the crofting counties. But crofting came in the 19th century, when you had things like the Highland clearances, when people were removed from the land by landlords and replaced by sheep, so they'd be thrown to the fringes, the coastal fringes, which perhaps were not fertile, and people couldn't look after themselves, or they were forced to emigrate to Canada or America or Australia, New Zealand, things like that, just so that the landlord could fill their estates with sheep, which were making them a lot of money with through wool and meat. So a lot of unrest, upheaval at that time, and then the Crofting Act came in, which gave crofters security of tenure. Basically, what that means today is that as long as I put my croft to an approved use, which would be agricultural or tourism, it has developed over the years. But as long as I work the croft, don't neglect it, and I live within, I think it's 32 kilometers of the croft, then basically I can't be touched. And I can then assign the tenancy to whoever I want, with the approval of the Crofting Commission, which is the crofting regulatory body. So that's it briefly, but a lot of people these days will move up and they'll think, oh, well, I'm going to buy a croft and everything will be hunky-dory, and think, well, I'll sell a couple of house sites, or I'll do this, do that, do the next thing. But they're totally unaware of how much legislation there is in crofting. So I have a croft. If I wanted to build a house in it, I'd have to get approval from the Crofting Commission to decroft a house site, and then I would have to build on that house site. But if I wanted that's more straightforward or easier to do. But if I wanted to, say, sell you a house site, I would have to go and decroft that house site, get permission to do that. But because it's not for me or for an immediate family member, it's a lot harder then.
Yeah.
And they've kind of clamped down on speculation, where people would say have good agricultural land and try and sell it for, four, five, six house sites and things like that. So they're kind of clamping down on that. Like, you put your croft to actual agricultural use, which is something great from my point of view. Crofting is also seen as one of the most important things with crofting, I think, right now, is that there's a croft house grant scheme. So that, for example, if I wanted to build a house, I can get a grant of up to, off the top of my head, 38,000, I think, to build a house. Now, you've got to go through the process and things like that, and apply for the grant, I think. But getting 38,000 towards building a house, which here was probably costs between 100,000 and 150,000. You know, that goes a long way towards towards building a house. So you know, it's a popular route for getting young people to stay in rural communities. That's one of the main things.
Okay.
So that's a quick run through of property. But if anybody is you know, I would just say if you're interested in it, go to the Crofty Commission website and, you know, Google it and, you know, read up about it more. But that's just a whistle stop tour. But there's so much more of it, so much more to it.
Yeah. Okay. But people who are crofters, such as yourself, are they all doing that with another job as well? Are they all sort of part time?
Yeah. So, again, talking about where I am in North Lewis, the crofts here were assigned in a way so that each croft would support a family. So it wasn't like you were supposed to make, the idea wasn't that you were supposed to make a living and, you know, be comfortable. But, well, you were supposed to survive. It was more about survival than thriving. You know, that's how I see it. So my croft is one of the bigger ones in Ness in my district. And it's 7 acres.
Yeah.
So 7 acres isn't a huge amount at all. But compared to some of the other areas in Lewis, it's smaller, because some of the other ones which aren't as fertile, their crofts might be 20 acres or 30 acres,
okay,
because they needed more to produce the same amount.
I see.
So yeah, crofting, it was here you always had to have a job. So you might have, My grandfather was a Harris Tweed weaver, and he was a school janitor. My mother, who still is a crofter, she was a teacher or a community development worker and a crofter. My father was a crofter, a fisherman and a crofter. Loads of people here work in the public sector, so you could be a doctor and a crofter, you could be a bin man and a crofter. It goes through the whole spectrum. I think one of the main things is there's not a class system in crofting where you've got, oh well, it's for the landed gentry, it's for the working classes. It goes right through everybody. You've got such a wide range of people, and you know, when you're there, you could be at a lamb sale, you know, around the ring, and everybody looks the same. You know, everybody's just in jeans and a check shirt, or whatever, as is the norm. But that man could be a solicitor, or that woman could be a cleaner. You know, it's totally, everybody's the same when it comes to crofting.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. So was it when you were a kid and your dad was fishing, he was obviously encouraging you to, like you say, do a white collar job, and you rebelled against that. Was it always, did you know that that was always what you wanted to do?
No, I didn't. All my earliest memories are all sheep related or croft related. So I remember going into the sheep with my grandfather. I remember them cutting hay and gathering it and things like that, or cutting peats, all these different things that I remember from my youth. And I'm the eldest. I've got three younger brothers, but I'm the eldest, so I was the one who was kind of, you know, the youngest. And when I was wee, it was a novelty. Bring the wee boy along, and you know, I learned all these things that my brothers probably didn't to the same degree. Yeah, you know, went to school. You know, I think I'm relatively capable. And kind of the default position in the Western Isles is, if you're smart, you're expected to go away to the mainland, to go to university, get a degree, and then the dream is that then you come back and make your life here. Now, what happens is you get loads of young people going away at 17, 18, getting their degrees, enjoying life. Some of them come back in their mid-20s. Some of them come back to raise families. Some of them don't come back till they retire. And some of them never come back.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the expected thing. And that's what happened to me. I didn't know what I wanted to do when I left school. I was really good at maths and physics, so I ended up going to Strathclyde University in Glasgow to do maths. And went down. I kind of enjoyed it, kind of didn't. It wasn't really for me. I kind of started petering out towards Christmas in the first year. And then I was home at the end of March. I was home the week before lambing started and the week before our local football season started. Now, some people might think that's pretty pathetic, but these are the two, where and are the two things that I enjoy the most. I love spring. I love Easter because our football season runs from April until September. And yeah. That's been a big thing for me. I've been playing, you know, for a senior team for 17 years. So that's been a big part of my life.
Yeah.
And lambing starts. So I would always time lambing so that it would happen during the Easter holiday, so that I'd be off school for the majority of it. And you know, my parents would do that as well, because if I'm interested and you've got somebody who's able to do everything for 2 weeks, of course you're gonna time everything to that time of year. So yeah, I went away, didn't enjoy it. So I came home then, and I did a degree in Gaelic and North Atlantic Studies, it was called then, in University of Highlands and Islands and Lewis Castle College in Stornoway. So I think it's a BA I did. So I did 3 years, got my degree. Anyway, my degree means nothing to me. It was just a paper exercise. It's something I can say, yeah, I'm capable. Here's my bit of paper that says I'm capable of learning, and I'm educated to degree level, but doesn't mean anything to me.
Yeah.
So
it was never something you planned to use. It was just.
No, it was no. It was my mother was head of Gaelic in the Lewis Castle College at the time. So she kind of forced me to go, because I came home and I was like, I came home in March, got lambing out of the way, and I was playing football. And what did I do? I got a job at a call centre. It was a dead end job. Never, oh my goodness, never, ever, ever work in a call center if you can avoid it. It was, yeah. I hated it. But anyway, she was like, I missed the intake. And it's small classes there anyway. So they never filled them. There was only like four or five of us there was eight of us in the first year. Anyway, I missed the first intake. And then she was like, right, you're not going to sit in your backside and be working in a call center. It's a dead end job. You're not going to do anything. Go be a student. Go do the degree. Right. Fine. Okay. I listened to my parents for once. So I ended up going to uni, got the degree. And probably the best thing I did while I was in getting my degree was I got a part-time job in the local shop. So that was the best thing, probably one of the best things I ever did in terms of dealing with people, but also getting to know my own community. That is where you get to know absolutely everybody, and it's almost like a social service that you're providing as well. You know, people come in and they might just be wanting a pint of milk or something like that, but they'll be there for 10-15 minutes. And when our newspapers used to come in around 10 o'clock, our newspapers would come in on the plane and, you know, be over in Stornoway, and it would be 10 o'clock before they were in the shop. And then there'd be this flurry of people coming in, and there'd just be so much activity, and it was really exciting, if exciting is a word for it. But it was always good. There was always a buzz about the place.
Yeah.
You get to know people. People get to know you. So I think that was probably one of the best things that happened to me while I was in college getting my degree. Anyway, got my degree. That was it, a bit of paper, and first job out of it was a graduate placement in my own community as a Gaelic development officer for a local development company. That was fine. It was just learning the ropes type thing. Just a job. That was only a 1 year contract. I went self-employed for a while, just doing Gaelic translations, and what else was I doing? Just bits and pieces, just random bits and pieces. I was doing really well.
But then the crash happened, the economic crash happened, and that kind of affected things a wee bit.
Yeah.
And I had the opportunity to apply for a job at the BBC, and I got a job as a broadcast journalist based in Stornoway. So that was mainly Gaelic news, but we do stuff in English as well. So there'd be like, that was really good because you become an expert in so many different subjects, things to do with education, things to do with transport, things to do with fuel. So you get to know the bigger picture of what's happening around you. And other things like I worked on, I was the lead journalist on a murder here. It was the first murder here in like a century, something like that.
Yeah, okay.
So that's eye-opening stuff.
Yeah. Wow.
So that was interesting. I got opportunities to do stuff in English as well. So there'd be like Good Morning Scotland, which is the Radio Scotland. I would do a lot onto that. I did stuff in Reporting Scotland, which is the regional, the Scottish news program on telly.
Yeah.
I did bits for Radio 4 as well. So yeah, a bit of variety like that. So that was interesting. Enjoyed that. But the other thing that happened at the BBC, I remember speaking to the cameraman that we had there, and I was like, tongue in cheek, what was I then? 2010 to 12, I was 20, 26. And I said to him, I don't know what I want to do when I grow up. And he said to me, you do, it's your sheep, but you just haven't figured out how to make it work for you yet. So that stuck with me for like, you know, since then. And left there, got a job at the council, and I was at the council until the spring. But I suppose now I can talk. It's probably about time we started talking about my actual crofting agricultural work. So did all that. But then in 2014, it kind of started taking the crofting side of things more seriously. But one of the reasons was the job that I was doing at the council. It was a European funded post about providing opportunities for young people to stay in the Western Isles through enterprise. So we were going around. There was five or six of us going around the schools talking to 16, 17, 18 year olds, highlighting the fact that they should be basically the long and the short of it was follow your dreams, do what you enjoy, and then we'll help you make a business out of it. And I was thinking to myself, I'm going around telling these kids to do that, but I'm not doing it myself. I'm in a job that I don't like, and I'm talking the talk, but I'm not walking the walk.
Yeah.
So anyway, 2014, just one bright sunny day, I ordered 320 hens, just with no infrastructure in place, no market research. I'm the kind of guy who needs pressure to make me do something.
Yeah.
Deadlines are there for breaking, as far as I'm concerned. So I'm quite laid back. So it was basically, so right, I've ordered 320 hens. Where am I going to put them? Where am I going to sell the eggs? You know, all that kind of stuff. Anyway, as always happens, it was all right in the end. And so got the 320 to begin with.
Yeah.
I'd had maybe 20 or 30 to begin with, just ended up accumulating them over the course of 3 or 4 years. And I was seeing that people were always wanting eggs. They were, you know, people at work were saying, oh, you got any eggs? Got any fresh eggs? Got any fresh eggs? I thought, I stuff it. There's obviously a market for it. But what I couldn't be bothered doing was going and trying to prove that there was a market for it and get letters of support and blah, 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 blah. I couldn't be bothered with all that side of things. At that point, there was nobody else selling any local eggs on any kind of scale. There might have been people like myself who had 20, 30 hens, but nobody had anything more.
Yeah.
So I took out a loan, bought the hens, the hen house, all the infrastructure. And it's kind of I went to the bank and I said, yeah, I'm gonna refurbish my house. So that's what I got the loan. So the house is still to be done.
That's sound business advice for any kids listening.
But yeah, The house still needs a bit of work, because I now own the house my grandparents had, which is on the same croft as my parents.
Okay.
So anyway, that's I hope I don't get in trouble for that. Anyway.
No one listens.
I haven't missed a payment or anything like that, so I should be fine.
You'll be fine.
Yeah. So did that. Basically, took me a wee while to figure out everything. I found that hens like going underneath the hen house and laying all their eggs there where I can't collect them. They're like, basically, I learned a lot of stuff very quickly when it comes to commercial egg production.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was brilliant. It's been making money. The one thing about the hen side of things, you know, I always read, you'll get a 78 or an 80% return on your eggs in year one and stuff like that. I don't get that. I think it's probably because we're so exposed. In the winter, we'll get, you know, I always remember a thing that was in the Independent one winter. I read it that London was bracing itself because it was going to be battered by gusts of up to 23 miles an hour. I have stronger farts than that. It really bugs me. We get basically in the winter from November until February, we get roughly 70 mile an hour once a week, 90 mile an hour about once a month, and then we'll get once a winter, we'll get one that ends up being about 110, 115 mile an hour.
Yeah.
So that's on a different scale to most of the UK. We're the first thing that the wind hits when it comes off the Atlantic.
I like so it when you post those, when you post those videos on Twitter when you're trying to talk into a hurricane. You're standing, barely able to stand upright. It is proper weather out there. It man's weather.
I remember some nights, you know, I'd be outside in 100 mile an hour winds, which I don't recommend, trying to gather up hens that I thought would be a good idea to shelter behind a pallet or something like that. So, you just kind of limit damage then and move animals to where they're going to be safe and basically move them away from houses where debris can fly off the houses and somewhere where there's a bit of natural shelter. So yeah, that's one thing.
You've got your own brand for the eggs as well, and you designed your own brand and you sell them.
That came a few years before. In 2012, I had my Facebook account suspended for 3 days because you're probably thinking, what did you say? What did you do? No, don't worry. But at lambing, I had a lamb born with no face. So I took a picture of it and I put it on Facebook because I think because we often talk about people not knowing where the food comes from, and I think there's this image that crofters or farmers are these barbaric people who just want to kill their animals and make money and, you know, swim in their blood type thing. You know, there's this ridiculous image. So, you know, I like being as open as possible about the dark side of things as well, because you know, when you're faced with a lamb born with no face, you know, it was alive when it was born, it didn't survive very long, then the thoughts that go through your head, you're like, there must be children born like this as well, but we don't hear about them, we don't see them, things like that, you know. And I've got this, and I put a picture of it on. I thought it was interesting, a lot of people were interesting, but then my account was suspended for 3 days for graphic violence, where there was absolutely no violence. So I then decided, right, stuff that, I'm going to make myself a wee blog. So I did that, and I called it Eireann Lot, Eireann Lot, which is Gaelic for it's our Gaelic for on the croft. Most places they will say Croich for Gaelic, C-R-O-I-T, but in our North Lewis colloquial Gaelic, we say a lot is a croft.
Okay.
So anyway, on the croft was a blog, and I, you know, I did that quite regularly for a few years, and it kind of became, while that was going on, I'd started thinking, right, I know what I'm going to do long term, so I keep this brand going.
Yeah.
About a year later, I launched a Facebook page, Evan Lott, the Facebook page, and I don't know, whatever, I got 3,500 likes or whatever on that. So I kind of keep that up to date, keep it entertaining, the dark side as well as, you know, I'll post about dead sheep as well as fluffy, cute lambs, you know, because it's the whole spectrum. I think it's important that people know the emotional roller coaster that the livestock holder has, as well as you know, it's not just the cute stuff.
No, I think people respect the honesty in that as well, don't they? I think that's what people want.
Well, some do, but then others say, you know, I had one wedder this summer on his back, and crows removed his tongue, and he was still alive, and I was feeding him. Unfortunately, he didn't make it, but you know, I posted a picture of him and said, "This is what happened." And I was getting somebody saying, "Why are you posting this on Facebook? This isn't what people want to see." I'm like, "If you don't want to see it, there's an unlike button. You don't have to look at what I post. You know, it's not all cute lambs. This is something I've had to deal with, something the animal has had to deal with, and I have been quite open about this since day one. I'll post the bad as well as the good. I kind of been thinking about my branding and that kind of thing since then, since very early on, before I was launching everything else. And I sell myself as Croft Eggs, Evan Lott, Croft Eggs from Ness. People are saying, oh, people not from the island are saying, go down the organic route. You know, if you go organic, you can get a premium for your eggs, and you can, you know, blah, 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 blah. It's like, no, organic doesn't sell here. People want local food, and they're more concerned about knowing the person and knowing if that person looks after their animals, rather than it's organic. Because what does organic mean? Some people are organic. That's fine. There's a market for organic. I know that there's no market here for organic, and it doesn't mean anything here. Croft produce means something here. Organic doesn't. So that was my decision not to go down that route. Just market it as Croft produce. Make it, you know, try and get the scale and the cost right as well, because the danger is that you make things a luxury rather than a necessity. Yeah. I'm as high as I can be without being a luxury, but it's as low as I can go as well, because it all depends on price of feed, price, and you know, since Brexit, the price of our feed is going up on a regular basis. You know, since the pound's going, pound and the euro going, and yeah, so lots of that. That was my branding, and I try and do everything, you know, thinking about the branding and trying to creep out with my local area and things like that. So there's that's the one thing that I think a lot of people here could do an awful lot better is branding it. It's not all about the produce. If the produce is good and the story that goes along with it is rubbish, people aren't going to buy it.
Yeah.
If the story is great but the produce is rubbish, people aren't going to buy it. But if you can get both a decent product and a decent story, then you're gonna be relatively successful. So I mean I know my product is pretty good, and I can tell a good story. I've got the story, you know, I'm from here, my parents are from here, we go back generations and generations, I'm a Gaelic speaker, I'm an active crofter, I'm young, I try things. People appreciate that and will buy it. And the number of people that come up to you and say, oh, I was in our social club last night, and there was a Cailleach. A Cailleach is an older woman. So there's a Cailleach there saying, oh, we were talking in Gaelic, but you're saying like, Where were your eggs the other day? I was looking for them, and I won't have any other eggs apart from your eggs. So make sure that they're in the shop when I go, and blah, 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 blah. So there's loads of people that come up to me and say that. And, you know, they'll be tongue in cheek giving me a telling off for not having eggs in the shop or stuff like that. But it says to me, yeah, that's good that people are after what I'm producing, and you know, it's worthwhile. I got so yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, and because you're also selling lamb and pork boxes, aren't you?
Yeah, that's something I started doing last year because, like I said before, we are the vast majority of lamb here, like 90% of lamb here, are sold store. And I was fed up of the fluctuations in the market. You know, you don't know what you're going to get. Some years you might get 25 to 35 pounds. Some years you might get 55 to 60. Yeah. In the ring and Stornoway here, I haven't seen a lamb go for more than 66 pounds. That's the highest price I've seen for lamb. And that was for the very, very best. I think probably the most I've ever got in the ring was like 55, 57 pounds. And that's if you catch it at the right time. So I decided last year, right, I'm going to start trying to sell my lamb. Now, one of the problems is there's no market locally for it, because if people want lamb, or although here we generally eat mutton, we'll eat 18-month-old wedders. Okay. That's traditionally what's eaten here. So if people want lamb or mutton, they'll know a crofter who they can get it off.
Yeah,
that's pretty much means that there's no real market for it locally. So this is my hoarse voice from last night starting to kick in after talking too much today. But using social media, I started marketing, advertising lamb and stuff like that. Last year, I went off to Inverness, Glasgow, and Edinburgh with 18, I think. That worked well. It was a bit of a trial run, and I made a wee profit, probably kind of broke even, depending, you know, going by the prices I would have got for them if I'd sold them in the ring. Yeah. But it was a bit of a trial run. Worked well though, got the logistics sorted. Ended up buying myself a fridge van this summer, and went away with pork in July. Went down to Glasgow with that again, sold all of that. This is people who'd be pre-ordering off me.
And this is all through online. All through your Facebook site.
Facebook and Twitter. That's the only ad. There is a web. I've got a website as well, but I don't actually have any meat advertised on there, and no meat boxes, because it's all just done on Facebook and Twitter. And I'm only looking to sell maybe 30-40 lambs each year. That's probably all I can handle just now.
Yeah.
So it's just starting, and you know, pigs were never traditionally kept here. I got pigs in 2009 for the first time, and kind of just kept the fatten them up for the freezer first, and then 2014 I got two females, and then I got a boar the following year, and had my first litters last year, and I've now got three sows and the boar. I've got nine porkers there ready to go in about 6 weeks or something like that. So got loads of orders for them just now. So it's a balancing act. I could keep more, but then they're not as exclusive. You know what I mean? Yeah. Because there's less of them, it means that I can say, well, I'm sold out now. So then people think, oh, it's sold out, it must be good stuff. So next time they'll be coming and saying, you know, and then I can have maybe 12 the next time. And you know, it's just about marketing and supply and demand and things like that.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's the thing. Now with the, I think probably with the pigs and the pork side of things, I don't know of anybody. I think I've probably got more pigs than anybody in the Western Isles. I certainly have more poultry than anybody in the Western Isles. But definitely not cattle and sheep. I'm well down the pecking order than that. But it's about being different. If everybody here had poultry, there would be nothing unique about my eggs. If everybody here had pigs, there'd be nothing unique about my pork. Those were two gaps I saw in the market, and I'm kind of going for them. The same with a lamb. There's nobody really pushing lamb here for a mainland market. So there's a real opportunity for that. And, you know, it's been working well for me. I was away in Edinburgh and Glasgow this week. I left on the first ferry on Wednesday morning, went down to Edinburgh, delivered there, delivered in Glasgow, and I came back Friday night, you know, made more money than I would have done selling these lambs in the ring. And the other thing I do as well is these lambs will be, when they go to slaughter, the slaughterhouse keeps the skins for me, and I send them off to a tannery, and then I can sell them as lambskin rugs and stuff like that.
So you're doing all the different things. You sort of successfully diversify your income stream. How do you? You're also on sort of TV a bit, and which I'll ask you a bit more about shortly. But how do you? All your neighbours, are they all very encouraging about that? That you're doing these different things.
It depends on who they are. I know when I got the hens, there's a lot of people who were like, what's he doing? He's crazy. Now, 3 years down the line, they can see that it's working. And it's kind of like, like I said, it depends on who they are. Probably guys my own age or it depends on their mindset, perhaps. That's what I should be saying. If they're a forward-thinking, entrepreneurial mindset, yeah, go do it. I can see where you're going with it. If they're maybe stubborn, set in their ways, it's like, oh, they do try and belittle you a wee bit. And it's not just me; it's anybody tries something a wee bit different. There'll be elements of who does he think he is? Who does he think he is being different from the rest of us? So there's that kind of things. But I have confidence in my own decision making. I take risks, but they're calculated risks. Like I said, you know, I went out and bought 320 hens without knowing if there was a market for it. I had a really good idea that there was a market for it, so it wasn't that big a risk. That side of things, and you know, with the lamb and stuff like that as well, there'll be people saying, "Oh, why aren't you selling your lamb? Why aren't you just putting it in the ring like everybody else?" Like, well, you get 50 quid for your lamb. I can clear double that by selling it as a meat box. So why should I throw away 50 quid extra for a wee bit more work? It's a no brainer. And I have these fights with my father as well. what my mother says is I'm very much like him in terms of the business side of things. She says when he was younger in his fishing days, he would be the one that would be trying different things, maybe going through different markets. I remember him fishing for dogfish, for Japanese shark fin soup market, fishing for velvet crabs for the Spanish market, going to prawns, brown crab. You know, there'd be different things all the time. So perhaps he just doesn't, when he's taking the risk himself, it was fine. But when he sees it's me taking the risk, he's like, whoa, just play it safe. But what that means is I do things. Like I bought these hens, I ordered these hens. He didn't know about it. I didn't tell him about that. Whenever I buy sheep, I don't tell him about that. They just appear in the car. He's got no idea how many sheep there are, because I do everything with the sheep. You know, I bought Highland cows last year. The first he knew of it was about half an hour before I went up to get them. I'd agreed to buy them in May, and this was August when I went to get them. And he knew when I was hitching up the trail. He's like, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going to buy. I'm off to buy some cows." And he just put his head in his hands. He was like, "When are you going to stop spending money?" And you know, and then last year he was like, "No, don't sell. Don't do meat boxes with lambs. Do it with wedders. Don't kill your lambs, just send them off to market. And I kind of semi listened to him last year, and I regretted it because I sold some decent lambs for okay prices, but not the price I would have got for them if I'd finished them myself. So this year, there's just been no wavering about it at all. I've just from the minute they're born, I know what's happening to the lambs and things like that. So I probably put one. Yeah, it's about having confidence in my own decision making and confidence in my own marketing as well. Because if you can't market it, then you are going to be I am going to be sitting here stuck with all these lambs, and I might be I'll put them on creep feed a little bit longer to make sure that I can finish them and things like that. So if I do sell them in the ring, they might get me a wee bit more money, but is it worth the extra feed that I've given them over the 4, 5, 6 months? Probably not. So I've got to sell them. I'm kind of forced to sell them as meat boxes. Otherwise, it hasn't been worth my while at all.
Yeah. Okay.
So yeah, there is that side of things, but there are a lot of really active entrepreneurial crofters who will try different things, who will experiment a wee bit and think outside the box. And I think there's probably a community there that is supportive. I see it everywhere. There's some people who just want to play it safe, plod on doing their thing. If that's what you want to do, perfect. I'm not going to criticize you for doing that. But equally, don't you criticize me for taking a risk and trying something else. I can see if it could benefit them long term as well. If I can't fulfill all the meat orders I get, I might buy their lambs off them. But if they're talking rubbish about me, then or something like that, then I'm not going to buy your lamb. I'll buy his lamb instead.
Okay.
Go on.
Constantly.
Well, I'm just going to say that you've just got to have confidence in your own abilities. I probably will be seen as arrogant in some people's eyes, and I don't think I'm arrogant, but I'm confident in my own abilities, my own decision making. So that's the main thing for me, that I'm comfortable in what I've done. If I've done something that I'm kind of wavering over and I make the wrong decision, then I'll regret it.
So do you think? So what we talked about there is you've done all these different things, and you've had to have the confidence to step outside the box and do these things. You also do quite a lot of TV work. Do you think that has helped in terms of gaining the confidence to do that?
No, because I think I had the confidence before the TV. That would be one of the reasons why I ended up doing it. BBC All Up is the Gaelic channel in Scotland, and that's from 2008. And the way I'd done broadcasting, as a contributor for since I was a wee boy. Basically, my mother's very good at speaking, my father's good at speaking. I always say I got a double dose of the gift of the gab and stubbornness. So I've got stubbornness and the ability to talk from both parents.
Yeah.
So one of my brothers, my brother number two, I entered him in a comedy writing program that was on Gaelic TV, like 2006 or something like that. And he got in and he did really well. And then in 2007, 2008, just before the Gaelic Channel launched, he did the same to me, and he put my name in for like a adventure holiday type program. So I ended up going to South Africa, Zambia, and Botswana for 10 days in February 2008.
Okay.
And I loved it. I love animals.
Yeah.
And it was really good seeing elephants and wildebeest and just everything. It was amazing.
Yeah.
And the company that produced the program, they really liked how I was on camera, and they liked my enthusiasm for animals. So they came back to me a couple of months later and said, would you be interested in presenting a program on sheepdog files? And I was like, yeah, yeah, sure, no problem. Thinking that it was like me and one camera and, you know, we'd be at a sheepdog trial somewhere. That's fine, I agree. Then I got the contract and I was like, look at this. Look at the number of days. Look at the money that they're paying me. I was like, this is bigger than I thought it was.
Yeah.
And anyway, the program's called Farpishin Chonchiroch, which is literally just sheepdog competitions is the direct literal translation. So we've just been presenting series 10 of it this summer. We've been so that's taken me places all over the UK and Ireland. Just come back from Gloucestershire. It was about two weeks ago. I was in Gloucestershire.
So you've presented all 10 series.
All 10 series. Wow. Yeah, myself and my co-presenter Katrina McPhee. She's down in Newton Mearns, just outside Glasgow, and but her parents are from South Uist. So we've presented, I don't know, we've probably about 100 episodes now, you know, round about 100 episodes,
yeah,
over the years. So I've been, you know, we were in Cirencester 2 weeks ago, and been all over England, all over Scotland, all over Ireland, wow, and Wales. And I do have to say, Will, that Wales is the worst place for driving through. You've got to get a motorway from North Wales to South Wales. It's an absolute nightmare, yeah, having to drive through Wales.
It is. You'll get no argument from me. It is.
People say, oh, but think of the views. It's like, we've got views of Scotland as well. I don't need views when I want to get somewhere in a hurry. If I'm going home, I just want to get cracking.
Yeah, there's only two decent roads in Wales. Yeah,
aye, the one in and the one back out.
Whoa! That's below the belt.
Anyway,
I set you up.
Moving swiftly on, but yeah, so I really enjoyed that, and I've had the opportunity to do other programs as well. Yeah. I presented one, you know, I'm a big guy, and I presented one on Highland Games as well in 2009, I think it was. So I entered competitions as well, and tossing the caber, all that kind of stuff. With one of the guys that was competing had been runner up and World's Strongest Man, and you know, these guys are, you know, I'm bigger than most people you'll meet on the street. You know, I'm 6'4". I'm, you know, 18 stone, yeah, and you know, but I'm not a wee guy. But then you know, when I'm competing with these guys, you see these guys launching things miles, and then I'm just like, just a wee pathetic throw of things. And it's like, it is eye-opening, yeah, because you go from, you know, I'm just like a punter off the street, and these are guys, it really shows that these guys were, you know, putting, that's their life.
Yeah.
They train for that all day long. And, you know, it's like putting me in goals against Cristiano Ronaldo. You know, it's the same kind of thing. Yeah. You know, you're talking about guys at the top of their game to amateurs. So did that, presented a few documentaries, and then in, when was it, a couple of years ago, BBC All Up did a six-part series on me and my enterprise called Unlocked / The Croft.
Yeah.
So basically just following me for the year, entertaining, ups and downs, following me from when the day the hens first arrived, to, you know, all the way through for the calendar year type thing. And whatever that, it was nominated for the Celtic Media Awards, so it was nominated for Best Factual Series there. We didn't win that one. BBC All Up said it was the most appreciated program of that year.
Wow.
I don't know what most appreciated program means. It didn't mean any more cash in my pocket, unfortunately. Yeah. We did a series 2 of it, and that was up until November. We stopped. The last day of filming was bonfire night last year, when we had a bonfire and the sheep went to the ram. So there was loads of fireworks.
Yeah,
you can play on that. And well, I've heard a couple of whispers about a third series, so I'll wait and see what happens in the next month or two, see if there will be a third series. But that, you know, I was talking about having done other, you know, the sheepdogs and other programs, you know, people would talk about that a wee bit. But then when I did the programs on the Croft, it was insane.
It was
everywhere I go. Yeah. It, just the reaction was totally, totally different. You know, my parents would be getting, you know, randoms coming up to them and saying, oh, who's looking after the hens today? Or, you know, oh, you're so patient, picked up there, and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, just, it's crazy. It was totally, totally, totally different to anything I'd experienced before. This is on a minute scale, obviously, but it's good fun.
When they're filming you doing that, are they just totally letting you do your thing, or are they giving you a bit of direction?
Yeah, well, that's what I was just about to say, because it's the production company's in Stornoway, the town on the island. The director's a crofter, the producer, the executive producer, they're all crofters. They all get it.
Yeah, okay.
They all get it. There's no that's the one real issue I have when I do stuff in English, is that a production company will come from down south, say, and they're like, this is the story we want to tell. I did something for the one show recently. It hasn't gone out yet, and it was like kind of like this. They had this is the story we're going to tell, and you're going to fit this story, rather than what's your story, let's find out what's interesting. It's like, this is what our viewers expect to see, and we're going to give them just what they expect to see.
Did they ask you to wear a kilt?
They didn't ask me to wear a kilt, but the thing is, I love wearing a kilt. See, that's the one thing, when you're my size, I've got the kind of legs that look good in a kilt.
That's
one thing that really bugs me, when it's like, just follows the stereotype. But that doesn't really happen in BBC All Up, because you're probably closer to your viewer. I probably know most of my viewers anyway. No, that's kind of the kind of thing. But so they got it. I know what I want the program to be like. And if it was fake or set up or anything like that, I don't think I would enjoy it, and the viewers wouldn't enjoy it either.
Yeah.
And probably the best feedback I get from people is that, you know, it's real. That's what working on a croft is like. That's what the dynamics of a crofting family are like. You know, my brother number three, next month he'll be ordained as a minister in the Free Church of Scotland. So we're like chalk and cheese almost. I love animals and he hates animals. He hates doing anything on the croft, and we've got the same sense of humor, but So it was yin and yang on the program, where I'd be like, I love doing this. This is great. Innes, my brother, Innes is coming to help me and doing this, that, and the next thing. And then cut to Innes going, I hate this. I hate animals. Why does he do this? I don't understand why he's got all this. You know, so it's totally different. But that's what it's like. You know, there'd be one family member, one sibling who will follow a particular line. But because it's a crofting, farming family, everybody has to be involved anyway, regardless of their interest, because it's kind of like all hands on deck when work needs to be done.
Yeah.
That's what happens, isn't it? That's what happens everywhere.
That's right.
So that's probably the main thing that people just say, it's realistic, you know, it's a true reflection, and I'm like, that means we're getting it right.
Yeah. Okay. So are you a bit of a celebrity on the island then?
I don't think we do celebrities here.
You haven't got people coming up to you wanting selfies with you and things like that.
No. I would say as a people here, we're very conservative that. I was in Gloucestershire 2 weeks ago, and Adam Henson was there, and I think to myself, you know, if I was from somewhere else, I'd probably be like, oh, there's Adam Henson, let's go and talk to him and let's take a selfie with him and blah, 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 blah. And Princess Anne was there. I was like, oh, well, I should go try and talk to Princess Anne. I was like, no, that's not what we do. We just like stand back, pretend we don't care, and things will go away. But so, I mean, I would say I have a high profile. I would say I have a high profile because of the TV side of things, but also because of the football side of things.
Yeah.
You know, that's, you know, there's, we've got a nine team league here, and you know, you get a few hundred people out to watch games and things like that. So you get to know people. You know, I've been playing for 17 years, so yeah. you get to know people, and you know, you'll have people giving you lip from behind the goal, and I have no problem at all giving them lip right back. But it's all in good fun.
Yeah. Why don't you tell us the story about 2009 with the football team?
So 2009, this is the best day of my life. So this is a good one. 2009, I was in where were we? Were we in Annan? We were in Annan, which is down to the borders, filming we were at the Scottish National Sheepdog Trial, and there's just cup competition in Lewis called the Elanen Reich Cup. It's the Isle of Heather Cup. I suppose it's called the Isle of Heather. That gives you an idea of how much heather there is in Lewis and Harris. So this is a special cup because it's a bit like international football. You can only play for the district that you were either born in, that you live in, your parents were born in. Okay. So it's kind of it's special like that.
So it's like the Basque football clubs in Spain.
Yes, yeah. So this was 2009. Ness hadn't been in the final since 1998, and we hadn't won it since 1987. So we made the final, and then, of course, it's the same day as I'm filming in Annan. And I was looking, you know, the semi-final was only like 2 weeks before the final was due to be played. So I was like, how the heck am I going to get back? Looked at the flights from Glasgow to Stornoway. I was like, it was fully booked. There was a tattoo on the same night, you know, like bagpipes and all that kind of stuff. So flight was fully booked. And that wasn't an option. I was in Annan, the other end of Scotland. There's no way I can get up for a ferry in time. The manager, and the other thing was, I was the only goalie. So, you know, the manager was like, I need to get you back. And the manager was like, right. He got in touch with Noel Edmonds and Alan Sugar to see if they could help. Unfortunately, I think he got a letter off Noel Edmonds, but Alan Sugar didn't respond at all. Noel Edmonds' PA or something like that. We were looking for helicopters, you know, looking for a helicopter to hire. Now, they eventually came across Hebridean Airways. And the manager who found them first, and I phoned the guy, and he was wanting $2,500 for the flight. I was like, there's no way I can afford $2,500. Anyway, managed to get it for £1,250 if I got publicity.
Okay.
It's like, right, fine, okay, I'll do that. So I on the Friday night, I went into Annan and I withdrew £1,250 cash from the bank. I slept with it under my pillow. I had a film in the morning. We were filming at the Sheepdog Trial. And then my brother drove from Glasgow. My brother number two works for the BBC in Glasgow. He drove down, picked me up, and drove me to Prestwick Airport and handed over the cash to the guy. It's like something you'd see in Narcos. You know, we're about to get on the plane. And he's counting out all the cash before we get on the plane. And then, now you're thinking, right, I've chartered a plane. So thinking, that's quite posh. What do you think I got for, you have a guess, Will, what do you think I got for chartering the plane? What do you think they gave me for sitting in the back? You know, I know you're thinking champagne, you know, strawberries and cream. I got a bottle of water and some earplugs. That was it. So flew home, landed in the Stornoway. The team bus was waiting for me there. But I'd spoken to, there was a journalist who I owed a favour to. So I spoke to him, and he appeared with a TV crew from STV, that's Channel 3 in Scotland. And we did a wee bit for the news. Went to the ground. I didn't do a warm-up. I lay on the pitch trying to calm myself down because it had been such an insane day. Fortunately, the boys played amazing, and we won 5-0. And it was the best day ever. And then we went to a party. We got the Ness FC social club. So we went to a party there, and then we all came back to my house for a party. And then I chucked everybody out of the house, and I had kept a trophy. And I woke up with a trophy in my bed on Sunday morning. So that was a pretty good night.
Yeah.
So
okay. Well, I read about it in the Daily Record article on it, and there's a quote from the manager at the time, Dougie Sharp, and I love this quote. He's because it's the most football manager quote ever. He's had a number of saves and a few touches. We really needed him. You just can't buy presents like that between the sticks. What a quote that is.
Yes. yes, Dougie's a good lad. So yeah, so that was it. And it was I'll never forget that day. That was just everything went so well.
Yeah.
One of my pals was playing for the other team, and he told me that because I kept it quiet. I didn't want people to know I was flying home. Because it would have put too much pressure on me, really. And he told me that the other team had a celebration that if they'd scored a goal, they were all going to do an airplane celebration. So I wish he told me before the game, because when you win 5-0, we scored the fifth goal with 10 minutes to go. I would have gone and done an airplane celebration in front of them.
Oh, that's awesome. What a story. Yeah, okay. Right, okay. Well, I've probably kept you long enough. So, as you know, I do a little quiz at the end of these. So, if you're ready, I'll kick in with that.
All right, on you go.
Okay, so what's your all-time favourite song?
Well, on the way back to Ness last night after winning the cup, one of the boys had his music on the phone. He's going, right, everybody choose a song, and I chose one song, and all the boys of the team know that's my favorite song. It's Crazy Nights by Kiss. Love it. Just get you pumped.
Great. I was expecting like Run Rig or someone like that.
Oh well, I could. That would be my backup. Then I'll up it by Run Rig. I like that one.
Yeah. Okay. All right. If you had to describe yourself with three words, what would they be?
Probably just say confident three times. No, I wouldn't. Confident. Confident. Risky. And. Different.
Okay. If you could time travel for a day, forward or back, where would you go to?
Vikings.
You would. You'd go back to then. Okay.
Yeah, I'd love to see what this place was like then as well. And
same place.
That's what I would do.
Same place in the Viking era. Okay. Okay. Good answer.
Well, yeah. Well, I said this is the center of the universe. Why would I go anywhere else?
Okay. Who would play you in Sweeney Ness the movie? Who's going to fly in on that? Who's going to fly in on that plane to save the day on that?
Well, you'd have to be a good goalkeeper. That's the thing. That's the thing, you know. I don't know.
Definitely, that's a difficult question. Not Sylvester Stallone in what was that?
yeah.
Escape to Victory.
Escape to Victory. That's probably some of my teammates might say that's closer to my own abilities. That's a difficult one. Who would be? Let's say Ewan McGregor, because he's Scottish as well.
Okay, all right. So lastly, if you had to,
it's boring. I know.
No, it's a good answer. If you had to recommend a farmer or someone in agriculture to follow on social media to a non-farmer, who would it be and why?
See, this is a difficult one. I knew this question was coming, but I haven't a clue. There are so many interesting ones.
Yeah.
I like following you. Can I tell people that you told me I had to say to follow you?
Don't tell Robinson. Don't tell James Robinson. I told you that.
Well, do you know what? I met him. I've been at Strictly. I've been there. We were filming. I was filming in. Where is he? I can't even remember where he is. Is it Cumbria?
Yeah, he's Kendall in Cumbria.
Wherever he is, I was filming nearby, and I tweeted about it, and he was like, "Oh, I'm just up the road." So I went and I got a tour of the farm with him in his Land Rover, which is pretty cool.
Yeah,
so I've been there. Lots of interesting ones. rural leader. She's good. Let me think. I like the island ones. There's different island ones. There's AJ McKenzie and Kenny McLeod down in Leverborough and Harris. I think they give really good image of what it's like in really rough terrain. Guys in the north of Scotland. I'm the apprentice in Iona, yeah. Mill Farm, Iona.
Yeah.
So there's loads of I like all these ones. The best thing about it, I think, is getting ideas from each other.
Yeah.
And comparing, you know, it's almost like a sounding board as well. You'd be like, what, how do you guys deal with this problem?
Yeah.
Or, you know, when we have similar issues. We're on an island. We've got travel issues. We've got ferry issues, ferry costs, haulage costs, things like that. Things that perhaps I'd say the vast majority of other people in agriculture don't have to contend with.
Yeah.
But when you're on an island, that stretch of water between you and the mainland adds time and money onto everything that you do. And time and money are the two things that we're all after.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Right. All right, then. Well, it has been brilliant to talk to you tonight because you are genuinely one of my favourite people to follow on Twitter for all the things we talked about tonight. And it's been great to learn a bit more about your life and the culture up there. So, yeah, keep up the good work and best of luck with everything you do going forward.
Yeah, no, same to you as well. I enjoy listening to the podcast. I was telling you before we started that. When I'm mucking out my hen house, I put it on and I'll be listening to podcasts. And everybody that's been on has been interesting for different reasons. And I just get so many ideas listening to other people. And it's really good listening to other people.
Yeah.
Lots of different concerns, lots of different issues, and good characters.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and yeah, next time you're down here in Wales on our crap roads, just... yeah, do look me up and call in, because I'm not too far from civilization. So yeah, call in.
Is it a good road out of there after I leave?
No, not really. Right, okay then. Thanks again, and to everyone at home, thanks for listening, for the ongoing support, nice comments, hugely appreciated as always. You can find the podcast from my Twitter page at Will Penry Evans, Stitcher app or iTunes. If you've got a minute and you're enjoying these, please could you leave me a positive review on there to help grow the podcast. It's a big help if you do that. Thanks to everyone who's done that lately. Thanks again. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night. Your name, it is pronounced Donal, isn't it?
No, it's not.
Oh, Christ almighty. I googled it and everything.